Chapter 15. On the first day of vigil, it rained most of the afternoon. The clouds had been piling up in the east all morning, growing thicker and more threatening, obscuring Fat Satan and his children so the day was even gloomier than usual. Near noon, the storm broke. It was a howler. The winds whistled by outside so loudly that the guard tower seemed to shake, and the rivers of brown water ran wildly through the streets and down glowstone gutters. When the suns broke through at last, they were already close to setting. Lartain glistened, its walls and buildings shining wetly and looking cleaner than Dirk had ever seen them. The fire fort seemed almost hopeful. But that was the first day of vigil. On the second day, things were back to normal. The Helleye rode a slow red path across the sky. Lartain glowered dim and black below, and the wind brought back the dust of the common that yesterday's rains had washed away. At dusk, Dirk spied an air car. It materialized high above the mountains, a black dot, and swept out over the common before turning back to descend on them. Dirk watched it carefully through the binoculars, his elbows resting on the stone sill of the narrow window. It was no car he knew, a dead black thing, a small stylized bat with wide wings and enormous headlamp eyes. Vickery was sharing that watch with him. Dirk called him over to the window, and Jan looked with disinterest.
"Yes, I know that craft," Jan said. "It is no matter to us, Telerium. Only the hunters from the Shanna Gate holding. Gwen reported seeing them leave this morning."
The air car had vanished by then, lost among the buildings of Lartain, and Vickery went back to his seat, leaving Dirk to reflect. In the days that followed, he saw the Shanna Gate several times, and they never ceased to seem unreal to him. How odd it was to think of them coming and going, untouched by all that had happened, living their lives as if Lartain was still the peaceful dying city it seemed, as if no one had perished. They were so close to it all, and yet so distant and uninvolved. He could imagine them returning to their holdfast on High Cavalan and reporting on how dull and uneventful life was on Warlorn. For them nothing had changed. Crine Lamia still sang its wailing dirge, and Challenge was still fervent with light and life and promise. He envied them. On the third day, Dirk woke from a particularly virulent nightmare in which he was fighting off Bretan alone, and he was unable to get back to sleep afterwards. Gwen, off watch, was pacing back and forth in the kitchen. Dirk poured himself a mug of Vickery's beer and listened to her for a while. "They should be here," she kept complaining. "I can't believe that they're still searching for Jan. Surely they must realize by now what's happened. Why aren't they here?" Dirk only shrugged at her and expressed hope that no one ever showed up. The Terek Nadala was due soon. When he said that, she spun on him angrily. "I don't care," she snapped. And then, ashamed, she flushed red and came to the table and sat down. Beneath a wide green headband, her eyes were haggard. She held his hand and told him haltingly that Vickery had not touched her since Janicek's death. Dirk told her that it would be better for them once the starship came, once they were safely off Warlorn, and Gwen smiled and agreed with him, and after a time she wept. When she finally left him, Dirk went back and found his whisper jewel and held it in his fist, remembering. On the fourth day, while Vickery was out on one of his dangerous dawn walks, Gwen and Arkin Ruach quarreled during a watch, and she hit him with the butt of her laser rifle, hard across his bruised face where the swelling had only recently responded to ice packs and ointments. Ruach came down the ladder from the tower muttering that she was mad again, trying to kill him. Dirk, awakened from a sound sleep, was standing in the common room, and the Kimdisi stopped dead when he saw him. Neither of them said anything, but after that Ruach lost weight rapidly, and Dirk was certain that Arkin knew what he had only suspected previously. On the morning of the sixth day, Ruach and Dirk were sharing a wordless watch when the short man, in a fit of pique, suddenly threw his laser across the room. "Filthy thing!" he exclaimed. "Wraiths, iron jades, I don't care. Cavalar animals is what they are, yes. And you, fine man from Avalon, eh? You are no better, no better at all. Look at you. I should have let you duel, kill or be killed like you wanted. That would have made you happy, yes? No doubt, no doubt.
loved sweet Gwen and made you a friend, and where is my gratitude? Where? Where? His fat cheeks were growing hollow and sunken. His pale eyes shifted restlessly. Dirk ignored him, and Ruark soon fell silent. But later on that same morning, after he had picked up his laser and sat for a few hours staring at the wall, the Kimdisi turned to Dirk once again.
I was her lover too, you know, he said. Oh, she didn't tell you that. I know, but it's the truth, the utter truth. On Avalon, long before she ever met Jantony and took her damn jade and silver, the night you sent her that whisper jewel. She was so drunk, you know. We talked, and she drank, and later on she took me to bed. And the next day she didn't even remember, you know that? She didn't even remember. But that doesn't matter. It's the truth. I was her lover, too. He trembled. I never told her, Telerion, or tried to make it come again. I'm not such a fool like you are, and I know what I am. And it was only a thing of that moment. Yet it existed, that moment. And I taught her a lot, and I was her friend. And I am very good at my work. Yes, I am. He stopped and caught his breath, and then silently left the tower, although there was still an hour to go before Gwen was scheduled to relieve him. When she finally came up, the first thing she did was ask Dirk what he had said to Arkin. Nothing, he replied truthfully. Then he asked her why, and she told him that Ruark had wakened her, crying, and telling her over and over that no matter what happened, she should make sure their work was published, and that his name belonged on it. No matter what he had done, his name belonged on it too. Dirk nodded and gave up his binoculars and his post by the window to Gwen, and very soon they were talking of other things. On the seventh day, the late-night watch fell to Dirk and Jan Vickery. The Kavalar city wore its dull, nighttime glow. The glowstone boulevards like sheets of black crystal beneath which red fires burned dimly, dimly. Near to midnight, a light appeared over the mountains. Dirk studied it as it flew toward the city. I don't know, he said, holding the binoculars. It's dark, hard to make out. I think I can see a vague outline of a dome, though. He lowered his glasses. Lorimar? Vickery stood over him. The air car grew closer. It slid silently above the city, and its silhouette was distinct.
It is his car, Jan said.
They watched it veer out over the common and circle back, heading for the cliff face and the entrance to the underground air lot. Vickery looked thoughtful.
I would not have believed it, he said.
They went down to rouse the others. The man emerged from the darkness of the undertubes to find himself facing two lasers. Gwen had a pistol trained on him, almost casually. Dirk, armed with one of the hunting rifles, had aimed at the tube doors and stood with the sight pressed against his cheek, ready to fire. Only Jan Vickery did not have a weapon out. He held his rifle loosely in his hands, and his sidearm was holstered. The tube doors slid shut behind him, and the man stood very still, understandably frightened. It was not Lorimar. It was not anyone Dirk knew. He lowered his rifle. The man's eyes touched each of them in turn and finally settled on Vickery.
"Hi, Ironjade," he said in a low voice. "Why do you accost me?"
He was a medium-sized man, horse-faced and bearded, with long blonde hair and a scrawny build. He was dressed in chameleon cloth that was somber red-gray now, flushed and feverish like the glowstone blocks of the pavement. Vickery reached over and gently pushed Gwen's pistol to the side. The act seemed to wake her. She frowned and holstered her weapon. "We were expecting Lorimar Highbraith," she said.
"The truth," Vickery affirmed. "No insult was intended, Shanagate. Honor to your holdfast, honor to your tane."
The horse-faced man nodded and looked relieved.
"And to yours, High Ironjade," he said. "No insult was taken."
He plucked at his nose nervously.
"You fly Braith property, do you not?"
He nodded.
"In truth, and ours by right of salvage. My tane and I stumbled on it in the wild while we pursued an Arnhorn in flight. The creature stopped to drink, and there the car was, abandoned by a lake."
"Abandoned? Are you quite certain of that?"
The man laughed.
I know Lorimar Highbraith and Fat Sanol too well, and take no chance of initiating high grievance with such as they. No, we found their bodies also. Some enemy had been waiting at their camp inside the aircar, we do believe, and when they returned from hunting, he gestured, they will take no more heads, mockman or otherwise.
Dead? Gwen's mouth was tight.
Entirely dead, each for several days, the Caviler replied. Scavengers had descended on the corpses, of course, yet there were still enough left to determine who they had been. We found another aircar close at hand in the lake itself, in truth, wrecked and useless, and also marks in the sand that indicated other cars had come and departed. Lorimar's vehicle was still functional, though full of dead Braith hounds. We cleaned it out and claimed it. My Tain is following me in our own car.
Vickery nodded.
These are very unusual events, the man was saying. He regarded the three of them shrewdly, with unconcealed interest. His gaze lingered for an uncomfortably long time on Dirk, and then on Gwen's black iron bracelet, but he commented on neither. Few Braes seem to be about of late, fewer than normal, and now we find two of them slain.
If you search hard enough, you'll find some others, Gwen said.
They're starting a new holdfast, Dirk added, in hell.
When the man had gone on his way, they began the slow walk back to the watchtower. No one spoke. Long shadows grew from their feet and followed them down the somber, crimson streets. Gwen walked as if she were exhausted. Vickery was almost jumpy. He carried his rifle warily, ready to snap it up and fire should Breton Braith suddenly take form in their path, and his eyes probed every alley and dark place along their route. Back in the brightness of the common room, Gwen and Dirk slumped quickly to the floor, while Jan stood for a moment just inside the door, his face thoughtful. Then he set down his weapons and broke out a bottle of wine, the same pungent vintage that he had shared with Garce and Dirk the night before the duel that never was. He poured three glasses and handed them round.
Drink, he said, raising his own glass in a toast. Things draw to a close. Now there is only Breton Braith left. Soon he shall be with his Chell, or I shall be with Garce, and in either case we will have peace.
He drained his glass very quickly. The others sipped.
Ruach should drink with us,
Vickery announced abruptly as he refilled his glass. The Kimdisi had not accompanied them to their midnight rendezvous. His reluctance had not seemed to be from fear, however. At least Dirk did not think so at the time. Jan had gotten him up, and Ruach had dressed with the rest of them, slipping into his finest silken suit and little scarlet beret. But when Vickery had handed him a rifle at the door, he had only looked at it with a curious smile and handed it back. Then he had said,
I have my own code, Jantony, and you must respect it. Thank you, but I think I will stay here.
He delivered the statement with quiet dignity. Beneath his white blonde hair, his eyes looked almost cheerful. Jan told him to continue the watch from the guard tower, and Ruach consented to that.
Arkin hates Cavalar wine, Gwen said wearily to Jan's suggestion.
That is no matter, Jan replied. This is a bonding between Kethi, not a party. He should drink with us.
He set down his wine glass and went up the ladder to the tower with easy grace. When he returned an instant later, he was less graceful. He dropped the last meter and stood staring at them.
Ruach will not drink with us, he declared. Ruach has hanged himself.
On that particular dawn, the eighth of their vigil, it was Dirk who went walking. He did not go into Lartain itself. Instead, he walked the city walls. They were 3 meters across, black stone covered over by thick slabs of glowstone, so there was no danger of falling. Dirk was alone on watch. Gwen had cut down Ruach's body and afterwards she had taken Jan to bed. Staring out on those walls with his laser uselessly in his hands and his binoculars around his neck, when the first of the yellow suns came up and the fires of night began to fade. The urge had come upon him suddenly. Breton Braith would not be coming back to the city, he knew. The watch was a useless formality now. He left his rifle leaning against the wall, next to the window, as he dressed warmly and went outside. He walked a long way. Other guard towers, much like their own, stood at regular intervals. He passed six of them and estimated the distance from tower to tower to be roughly a third of a kilometer. Every tower had its gargoyle, and none of the gargoyles were quite alike, he noticed. Now, after everything, he suddenly recognized them. They were untraditional, those gargoyles, not old earth cast at all. They were the demons of Kavalar myth, grotesque, mythologized versions of Dactyloids and Harun and the Githyanki Soulsucks, all real, in a sense, somewhere among the stars. Each of those races still lived. The stars. Dirk paused and looked up. The Helai had begun to edge above the horizon. Most of the stars were gone already. He saw only one, very faint, a tiny red pinpoint framed by wisps of grey clouds. Even as he watched, it vanished. High Kavalan star, he thought. Gas Janasek had shown it to him, a beacon for his run. There were too few stars out here anyway. These were no places for men to live, these worlds like Warlorn and High Kavalan and Dark Dawn, these outworlds. The great black sea was too close on one hand, and the Tempter's Veil screened off most of the galaxy, and the skies were bleak and empty. A sky ought to have stars. A man ought to have a code, too, a friend, a tane, a cause, something beyond himself. Dirk walked to the outer edge of the walls and stood staring down. It was a long, long drop. The first time he had sailed over the wall in a skyscoot, he'd lost his balance just from looking at it. The walls went down a ways, and below them the cliff went down forever, and way at the bottom a river ran through greenery and morning mists. He stood with his hands in his pockets, the winds ruffling his hair, shivering a bit. He stood and he looked. Then he took out his whisper jewel. He rubbed it between thumb and forefinger, as if it were a good luck charm. Jenny, he thought. Where had she gone? Even the jewel did not summon her back to him. Footsteps sounded nearby, then a voice.
Honor to your holdfast, honor to your tane.
Dirk turned, the whisper jewel still in his hand. An old man was standing next to him, tall as Jan and old as poor dead Chell. He was massive and leonine, with a head of wild snow-white hair that blended into an equally stormy beard to form one magnificent mane. Yet his face was tired and faded, as if he had worn it a few centuries too long. Only his eyes stood out, intensely, insanely blue eyes, eyes like Gas Janasek once had, burning with icy fevers beneath his bushy brows. "I have no holdfast," Dirk said. "I have no tane."
"I'm sorry," the man said. "An off-worlder, eh?"
Dirk bowed. The old man chuckled.
"Well, you haunt the wrong city, then, ghost?"
"Ghost?"
"A ghost of the festival," the old man said. "What else could you be? This is Warlorn, and the living men have all gone home."
He was wearing a black woolen cape with huge pockets over garments of faded blue. A heavy disc of stainless steel hung just beneath his beard, suspended on a leather thong. When he took his hands from the pockets of his cape, Dirk saw that one of his fingers was missing. He wore no bracelets. "You have no tane," Dirk said. The old man grumbled.
"Of course I had a tane, ghost. I was a poet, not a priest. What sort of question is that? Beware, I might take insult."
"You wear no iron and fire," Dirk pointed out.
"Truth enough, yet what of it? Ghosts need no jewelry. My tane is 30 years dead, haunting some holdfast back in Red Steel, I imagine, and I'm here haunting Warlorn. Well, only Lartane, if truth be known. Haunting an entire planet would be rather exhausting."
"Oh," Dirk said, smiling, "then you're a ghost too."
"Well, yes," the old man replied. "Here I stand, talking to you, for lack of a good chain to rattle. What do you think I am?"
"I think," Dirk said, I think you might just be Kirak Redsteel Kavis.
Kirak Redsteel Kavis, the old man repeated in a gruff, sing-song manner. I know him, a ghost if there ever was one. His particular fate is to haunt the corpse of Kavalar poetry. He goes about at night moaning and reciting lines from the laments of James Lyon Tal and some of the better sonnets of Eric High Anjay Devlin. During the full moon he sings Braith battle chanties and sometimes the old cannibal dirge from the deep cold dwellings. A ghost in truth and a most pathetic one. When he especially wants to torment one of his victims, he recites some of his own verse. I assure you that once you have heard Kirak Redsteel read, you pray for rattling chains.
Yes, Dirk said. I don't see why being a poet is quite so ghostly in and of itself.
Kirak Redsteel writes old Kavalar poetry, the man said with a frown, and that is enough. It is a dying language. So who will read what he writes? In his own Hulfas, men grew up speaking only standard star talk. Perhaps they will translate his poetry, but it is really hardly worth the effort, you know. In translation, it does not rhyme, and the meter limps along like a broken-backed mockman. None of it is any good in translation, not a bit. The rattling cadences of Garling Glowstone, the sweet hymns of Laris Blind Hyken, all those dreary little shanigates exalting the iron and fire, even the songs of the Ein Kethi, those hardly count as poetry at all. All dead, every bit of it, surviving only in Kirak Redsteel. Yes, the man is a ghost. Why else did he come to Warlorn? This is a world for ghosts.
The old man tugged at his beard and regarded Dirk.
You were the ghosts of some tourist, I would venture. No doubt you got lost while looking for a bathroom, and you've been wandering ever since.
No, Dirk said. No, I was looking for something else. He smiled and held up his whisper jewel. The old man studied it, squinting his hard blue eyes while the cold wind flapped his cape.
Whatever it is probably dead, he said.
Far below them, down near the river that ran sparkling through the common, a sound came drifting up, a faint, far-off wail of a banshee. Dirk's head snapped around, and he looked to see where the sound had come from. There was nothing. Nothing. Only the two of them standing on the wall, and the wind pulling at them, and the hell-eye high in the twilight sky. No banshee. The time for banshees had passed here. They were all extinct. Dead? Dirk said.
Warlorn is full of dead things, the old man said, and people looking for dead things and ghosts.
He mumbled something in old Kavalar, something Dirk did not quite catch, and he began to move off slowly. Dirk watched him go. He glanced toward the distant horizon, obscured by a bank of blue-gray clouds. Somewhere in that direction was the space field, and, he was certain, Bretan Braith. Ah, Jenny, he said, talking to the whisper jewel. He flicked it out away from him, as a boy might skip a stone, and it went far and far before it began to fall. He thought for a moment of Gwen and Jan, and for several moments of Garse. Then he turned back to the old man and called out after his retreating figure. Ghost, he shouted. Wait, a favor for me. One ghost to another? The old man stopped.